idea what the difference is between Baptist or Anglican or Uniting. I came to that church because my sister invited me, and I stayed because it felt like home. It felt like it could be a community where I could grow in what it means to be a disciple of Jesus. And I've been in this Baptist kind of world for a while now, but lately I've started to feel like it's not always home anymore. And I don't know if anyone's had a similar feeling. Sometimes this can happen, you know, in our church. Maybe we've been part of a church for a long time and it feels really familiar, and then one day something happens and suddenly it feels unfamiliar. Or maybe you've wondered, like, why are there so many different denominations? What does it mean to be the church today? There's less and less people engaging in church, and that can kind of be disorientating. Maybe we're thinking, why be part of a church? Or what is the church meant to be? So in the news recently, the Southern Baptists were in the news, and the Southern Baptists are the largest Baptist association in the world. But sometimes when I hear about them, I feel like we're very different. So the Southern Baptists have historically supported slavery. They supported segregation. And more recently, in the 1980s, they've taken a really hard stance on the question about whether women can be pastors. And they've said clearly, no. Now, last year, one of their biggest and perhaps well-known churches, Saddleback Church, led by Rick Warren, which some of you may have heard of, was expelled from the Southern Baptist Convention because they had called a female associate pastor to their church. And so this year, Rick Warren has run this big campaign trying to reverse that decision. So he's like created this whole website. And if you know anything about Rick Warren, there's always lots of videos of himself. So he's like filmed himself talking about what it means to be Baptist and calling on the Southern Baptists to reverse this decision. Now, if you don't know anything about Baptists, the one thing you should know is that we love to talk. So our meetings can be very long because anybody can talk. And then we vote. So this convention meets, lots and lots of people. Rick Warren gives his spiel, and so does lots of other people. And the vote comes back 88% in favour of keeping Saddleback expelled from the convention. And I was kind of following this, and I felt really disorientated and disheartened. And I'm thinking, is this what the church is meant to be? So partly this term, we're thinking about, you know, what does it mean to be Baptist? But we could also ask more generally, like, what does it mean to be the church? And this is kind of the question that the people of Judah were asking as well as they were in exile. They were a small community that has been dislocated. They're in this foreign land. They've kind of been jostled by powers that feel greater than they. And they face the danger of losing themselves completely in this new land and kind of disappearing. And so they're trying to work out what is happening and where is God in this? And so we come to Isaiah 41, and Isaiah 41 is kind of God's response, trying to unpack that question, but as always is the case, God kind of goes in maybe a direction you don't anticipate. So Isaiah 41 begins with God calling for silence, not just Judah, but the islands, the nations, all are to be quiet. And when silence falls, God gives this answer, verse 2. Who has stirred up this king from the east, rightly calling him to God's service? Who gives this man victory over many nations and permits him to trample their kings underfoot? With his sword, he reduces armies to dust. With his bow, he scatters them like chaff before the wind. He chases them away and goes on safely, though he is walking over unfamiliar ground. Who has done such mighty deeds, summoning each new generation from the beginning of time? It is I, Yahweh, the first and the last. I alone am He. They are Yahweh's people. And who is Yahweh? The first and the last, the beginning and the end, the God of history. And that means not just the past, but the present and the future. God wants people to know that He is creating and propelling history forward. Now, this has been a theme throughout Isaiah. There's been a lot of talk about the nations and what's happening at a like geopolitical level. And Isaiah keeps saying this is God at work in history. And in this particular instance, it's speaking about God raising up some leader or ruler who's going to come and conquer all these nations, including Babylon. Now, we don't know yet who this ruler is, although, you know, spoiler alert, it will be revealed in a few chapters, but just in case you're not, I won't spoil it yet. So we don't know exactly who it is, but someone coming. But this is really important because it keeps coming up. Again, in verse 25, later in this chapter, Yahweh says, I am raising up this leader and I'm going to give this leader victory. And I'm telling you this ahead of time so that you will know it is me. This is good news for Judah because they have been exiled in Babylon, and this is God saying to them, I'm going to work to set you free. I'm going to deliver you. You're scattered now in exile, but I'm going to gather you. I still have plans for you. I'm still at work. It might feel like I've discarded or abandoned you, but I'm still at work, and I'm telling you this so that you won't feel like there's somebody else to turn to. Like, no other God can tell you what's going to happen. There's no other force at work. There's only me. I'm the only one able to work in time and understand what's happening across time. So in a time of disorientation, I've been trying to look for a Baptist who inspires rather than depresses me. And I've chosen a pretty, like, very famous, well-known, I don't know if he's well-known for being Baptist, but Martin Luther King Jr., was a Baptist pastor. And I've been reflecting on his life a little bit, and I see echoes to Isaiah here. So Martin Luther King, as I'm sure many of you would know, lived in the mid-20th century. And he lived in a time when the black community in the US felt really dislocated. Like, they had their history as one of being plucked from one country and dumped into another. They've been severely mistreated and segregated. And he will actually speak about feeling like they're in exile, right? So you're at home, but not at home in your own country. In 1954, he becomes a pastor at Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery, Alabama. And like a good pastor, he gets to know his community, so he's meeting people, hearing their stories. And his observations of the neighborhood is just that everyone feels really dispirited. It feels like there's these powerful forces like kind of jostling and holding them down. And yet he believes that this is a community that's loved by God. Who are we meant to be? We're meant to be people of the Spirit. And King believed that the Spirit of God is still at work creating and shaping history right now. And his time in particular, he saw Rosa Parks as an example of God at work through time. Rosa Parks sits on a bus, refuses to get up when it becomes crowded and some white person wants her seat. She's arrested for that. And then this spark is lit. The black churches gather and they decide to call for a bus boycott. They're not sure if people are going to embrace this, but the whole community does. Everyone just stops catching the bus and they actually start working together. Some people give money, some people carpool or start paying for taxis. A lot of people just start walking long distances to work, but everyone gets on board and they says, we're not going to catch public transport until we're treated with respect. This boycott goes on for 382 days. And then finally, it goes before the courts and these bus laws are deemed to be unconstitutional. And so they're changed. King says this is a victory, but this is actually more than a victory. This is a wonder of God. This is the Spirit of God at work in history. And he says this because he knows the scriptures, he knows the prophets, and he's also influenced at the time by this German philosopher called Hegel, who also speculated that the history is not random, right? That it's moving towards something. He talked about this world spirit kind of moving people towards greater freedom. And that phrase Zeitgeist kind of comes from Hegel, the idea that there's like a spirit to every age or a flavor to every age, but always each age is kind of progressing onwards. And kind of King absorbed that idea and also the scriptures. And so he says this is a quote from King. As a Christian, I believe that there is a creative personal power in this universe who is the ground and essence of all reality, a power that cannot be explained in materialistic terms. History is ultimately guided by spirit, not matter. Who are we meant to be? Well, Israel was called to be God's servant. And you'll notice a lot in the Bible, the Bible often repeats itself, it often retells the history of the people, and partly this is for identity purposes, right? We are shaped by the stories that we tell. And so Isaiah says, remember your history, remember Abraham, my good friend? I created history when I spoke to Abraham. Through Abraham, I said, I'm going to bless all the nations. And this movement started towards that. Now, again, you might feel like I've abandoned you, but that's not the case. History gets complicated. The nation of Israel, these descendants from Abraham, fight, they split. And so then we have like the northern kingdom, which we call Israel, and they get completely decimated, wiped out by the Assyrians. And at that point, that nation kind of disappears. They lose their identity in that process, and we kind of don't hear about them anymore. And then the focus becomes the southern kingdom, Judah, which we've been following, and they get conquered by Babylon. And I guess they're like fearing that their fate will be the same as Israel. But God says here, no, you are kind of like the remnant. You're like the Israel that's left, and I have chosen you. So don't be discouraged. Don't be afraid. You might feel small. You might feel like you're nothing but a lowly worm. But I still have purposes for you, and there's still things for you to do. King had this sense that he was called to serve God, to serve the church, and ultimately kind of his nation and I guess beyond. But he speaks about this particular moment during the boyfight in January 1956. He's at home, it's late, his wife's gone to bed, they have a newborn child, so the child's asleep. And he's in his home and the phone rings and he picks it up and it's someone like threatening him, which was a common occurrence. And he puts the phone down and then he's like trying to, you know, do normal stuff. So he makes a cup of coffee and he's halfway through making this cup of coffee and then he just stops and he prays in the kitchen and he says this, I'm at the end of my powers. I have nothing left. I've come to the point where I can't face it alone. And for the first time in his life, he says he experiences this extraordinary closeness with God. Like he said, he didn't really feel like he had a particular call to pastoral ministry. Sometimes pastors speak about this, but he's like, no, I just kind of, you know, ended up in that ministry. But at this moment, he has this experience of like the Spirit, and he feels like he hears this voice saying to him, I want you to stand for what is right, and I'm going to be with you every step of the way. And kind of that mobilizes and encourages him to keep going. Now, throughout his life, he will have periods when he'll feel extreme depression, or he'll feel afraid, or he'll feel disorientated, and he'll have similar experiences. He'll never hear like a voice again, kind of like what he did at that night, but he'll have experiences where he'll feel encouraged, like the Spirit is close to him, or sometimes he'll speak about like getting up to speak and feeling like the Spirit gives him the words to say. King, like Isaiah, is someone who knows that he is a person filled with the Spirit and called to serve God. Isaiah says to the people of Israel, this is who you are. You're called to serve God, and God has big plans. Like, you might feel really small, but God has plans to, like, transform deserts. So where there is desert, there's going to be rivers gushing through. Where there is wasteland, God is going to plant trees. And if this is what God is doing, then this is who you are called to be. Isaiah 42, verse 1. Look at my servant whom I strengthen. He is my chosen one who pleases me. I've put my Spirit upon him. He'll bring justice to the nations. He will not shout or raise his voice in public. He'll not crush the weakest reed or put out a flickering candle. He'll bring justice to all who have been wronged. He'll not falter or lose heart until justice prevails throughout the earth. Even distant lands beyond the sea will wait for his instruction. This servant is to bring justice to the nations. The temptation when you're feeling small or like you're in decline is kind of, yes, to seek the Spirit, because that's very comforting, but then kind of like to stay small and tighten and control what you can. But God's like, no, 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 I don't care if you're small. I have big plans for you. I'm calling you to enact justice in the world. This is what God has been working towards throughout time, justice, mishpat. It means to like reorder whole societies and nations so that everybody, including the most vulnerable, have the opportunity to flourish. It's about wholeness and compassion and doing what is right and pursuing what is true. And we do this because every single person has the breath of God in them, says Isaiah. Genesis says every single person is made in the image of God, which means that they are valuable, that they are loved, and this should transform the way that we do life together. We are to be people who pursue love and freedom and justice and truth. Israel was called to be a light to the nations. They were called to liberate others, to share this, to pass this on, to live this way and kind of invite other people, so that this image is that the whole world kind of catches this vision, that the whole world becomes a place where justice reigns. Isaiah speaks about the work that God is doing is like a mother giving birth in labor, that this is what God is doing, trying to usher something new and wonderful for this world. This is known as a servant song in Isaiah, and this is the first in a series of servant songs that will come. This figure of the servant keeps popping up in this section of Isaiah. And so this has led to a lot of speculation and debate and maybe disorientation about who this servant is, because it's kind of this extraordinary description. I think in the first instance, to me anyway, it's clear that it's meant to be Israel. This is who Israel is called to be. Occasionally in Isaiah, we will hear like individuals referred to as servants. So earlier in Isaiah, Isaiah the prophet speaks about being a servant of God. Sometimes kings call themselves servants, but these servants are always there to empower and equip the community to be the servant. So this is the hope, this is the expectation that Israel will be this, but also the nation struggles to live this out, right? And we see a hint of this struggle towards the end of chapter 42, verse 18. Listen, you who are deaf, look and see, you blind. Who is as blind as my own people, my servant? Who is as deaf as my messenger? Who is as blind as my chosen people, the servant of Yahweh? You see and recognize what is right, but refuse to act on it. You hear with your ears, but you don't really listen. Nothing can ultimately thwart God. God is at work creating history. And so in history, out of Israel, we see Jesus appear in a particular time and place. And in Matthew's gospel, Matthew kind of introduces us to Jesus, and we see Jesus healing the sick, pronouncing that God's kingdom is coming, gathering people to him. He also faces, you know, death threats very early on by the religious leaders. And in the middle of that, Matthew sees Jesus and describes Jesus as fulfilling the words of Isaiah. He actually quotes Isaiah 42 here, and he says, "This is the servant." Jesus is beloved by God, and we see the Spirit come upon Jesus in order that Jesus will come proclaiming justice to the nations and bringing hope to the world. So as people who seek to follow Jesus, there is a sense then that we can take these words of Isaiah, and they kind of also then become our words too, because we have the same Spirit at work in us. Who are we meant to be? The church, first and foremost, are meant to be people who serve Jesus, people who are committed to Jesus. This is not just, you know, the Baptist church or a particular branch of the church. The whole church declares that Jesus is Lord, and we follow then Jesus' purposes. We seek to proclaim justice to the world and hope to the nations. King, when he was looking around in his time, thought that there was a spiritual problem. Like, he could see injustice, he could see violence and poverty in his country, and he saw it as a real spiritual issue, that this was something that was damaging everybody. And so he felt propelled to pursue justice because he followed God, but he wanted to not just pursue justice, he wanted to pursue justice in the way of Jesus. So during this boycott, probably only actually a few weeks after this phone call and this experience of the Spirit, you know, he's been getting all these death threats. His house is firebombed. Thankfully, no one is injured. He's not at home. His wife and child is, but they're kind of at the back of the house and they're okay. But a lot of people get really upset. And so all these supporters kind of come to the outside of the house. Some of them are carrying weapons and, you know, they kind of want to retaliate. And he comes in and he steps into this crowd and he says to them, like, we can't use violence. We have to love our enemies. Now, that sounds so crazy to say that, particularly when everybody's very worked up. And he's like, this could have gone very wrong. But for him, it felt like the Spirit of God was there in that moment. He says, the crowd walked away. They left. There was no violence. And he said, like, it wasn't my words. It was the Spirit of God restraining people's hearts, enabling us to pursue peace in the way of Jesus. Now, the boycott is kind of the beginning in a lot of ways of King's ministry. And so he has many more years ahead and there will be a lot more suffering that he'll endure. And it will get tricky. It's tricky sometimes to know what the right thing to do, and there'll be different people who have different perspectives. And you have to try and navigate a way through that. In 1961, the Baptist National Convention, which is the largest black Baptist denomination, they end up splitting. And they end up splitting on this issue because some people think, like King and others like him, they're too radical. They say, is this really what the church is called to be in? Like, this civil rights activism, I think we're getting, like, too involved. Maybe we need to take a step back. And the denomination splits. King and others like him establish the Baptist Progressive Association kind of in response. I was reading a book that was, like, reflecting on King's spirituality and his reflection on the church. And I came across this quote that kind of is perhaps how King viewed at least the black church. It says, although King was critical of the black church for its emotionalism, fundamentalism, and otherworldly emphasis, it continues to enact the Christian story and has not rationalized away the harder demands of the prophets and Jesus. It still understands that the churches heal the brokenhearted, preach deliverance to captives, and announce the acceptable year of the Lord, much unlike the white church. Not everyone would agree with King on every issue. I don't. He wasn't a huge supporter of women in ministry, so we disagree at that point. And he wasn't perfect. But he was someone trying to follow Jesus in the particular time that he found himself in. And he, along with others, were asking, what does it mean to be the church now? So here I am, part of a Baptist church, which I love. But we are part of a broader movement as well. And we find ourselves jostled by powers that seem greater than us. There's less people engaged in church, so that can feel disorientating. And also, you may or may not be aware, but as a state association, we've been having a very long and painful conversation about what it means to be a Baptist and who can be part of our association. And there's the threat of expulsion kind of in the air. But when I see Isaiah and I see history, I'm reminded that this is nothing new, right? That there's regularly been tensions and debates and splits. In the middle of that, God brings this word to those who are feeling dislocated or disorientated. I'm still here. I'm still at work. God says, in every generation, I'm performing mighty deeds and wonders. I am the God of the beginning and the end, and I'm at work particularly for those who are most vulnerable. This is who I'm calling you to be. I'm gathering a people who will be committed to Jesus, who will be filled with the Spirit, and who will proclaim justice, who will be involved in the works of justice and bringing hope to the world. This is who we are to be, and this is who we are to proclaim. Jesus Christ as Lord. Amen. Amen.